Very glad to be here, and thank you for that sweet introduction. I'll throw in, it's a very recent thing for me to be a Dr. Dark. My brother, who teaches at Tennessee State University, has been Dr. Dark for a long time, and when I had conferred upon me that title, we decided that we could distinguish between ourselves by letting my brother be the DC Comics Dr. Dark, and I'm the Marvel Comics Dr. Dark. So by that, maybe that distinction will help you make some sense of what I have to offer for you today. I want to, today is intended to provoke at least a little bit. Let me throw in now, in case I forget, that I'm very up for being spoken to later on via email or here. Concerning questions you might have for me, or questions like, well, if you say you believe this, then how you can you believe that? And I'll be around afterwards for anyone who wants to talk. I don't always throw this in, but I feel kind of compelled to, just to give you a celebrity association / learning tool. Are you familiar with the band Switchfoot? Yes, okay, those might be the most nods I get the entire morning. Okay, the band Switchfoot. It happens that through marriage, I am the brother of John Foreman of Switchfoot. There was even a cry. Okay, so with that, if at any point you're thinking about dozing off, or why am I listening to this guy? I could be changing my Facebook status right now. Think to yourself, hold on a minute, that is John Foreman's brother. And this is me. Excuse me, this is John Foreman, and this is me. So you can do this little gesture to yourself to look, oh, I need to be listening because of his connection. Okay, so there's that. All right. The possibility of Christianity. I'll start with a story, and I will ask you to try and think of a continuum of the possibility of Christianity, a trajectory. In my upbringing, I grew up afraid of not being Christian. I don't think, and there was some fear in that. I read the Bible all the way through at a fairly early age, merely for fear of what might happen to me if I got caught dead without having read the Bible all the way through. So there was some fear stuff there that I try to address in my books, and I try to exercise with a O in it. In my talks that wasn't so good, that I wouldn't wish upon my children. But there was also this pinch continuum. Am I in, and you know, I thought of the song, standing on the rock where Moses stood, standing on the rock where Jesus stood, am I up for that? Do I want to be a part of that? I even think of the St. Patrick bit and the First John thing, and there was this feeling of if you don't love, you don't know God. You're not of God. We are of God, in with God, in sync with God's good purposes to the extent that we're actively loving people, perhaps especially those people that we're least inclined to even like. So I had that in my upbringing in a kind of dysfunctional way, but also in a way that I would want to pass on. And here's the story. My brother and I, who would both be Dr. Darks in time, were playing in our front yard with each other when we realized that we were experiencing a kind of rock shower from across the street. A neighbor, a very lively neighbor and his friend, both older than us, were throwing rocks at us. And it was terrifying. It was an unprovoked attack. And their aggression was like nothing we had ever known. We were both confounded and afraid. We ran, but before gathering much speed, it seemed to me that it would be appropriate to pick up one of those rocks and hurl it back in their direction just to hold on to some kind of decency and manliness. So I threw it helplessly in the direction of my attackers. When we made it into our home, and my brother and I were 19 and 20 when this happened. No, I'm just kidding. No, we were, I was probably 6 and my brother was 7 or 8. We run back in, tearful, Tearful complaining, wild-eyed retelling. My mother listens, but she listens quietly, but she only has one question for us as we're telling this, which is, did you throw any rocks at them? Already well-versed in the politics of just desserts and eye for an eye, I begrudgingly admitted that there was one retaliatory rock that I had thrown, but I didn't really see what that had to do with the terror to which I had just been subjected. As my mother accompanied me to the home of the neighbor child, she made no explicit reference to nonviolence, though she herself was part of what we could call the civil rights movement, nor anything about following Jesus. But I knew, through having been brought up this way, the biblical injunction about not returning evil for evil, and I knew that I was being taken over there, not to tell on the kid, but to apologize for the one rock that I had thrown, and that I would not be allowed, the way we ran our household, to say anything about what provoked it. I'd long been made to understand, as my mother often put it, we do things differently in our house. Made to apologize for the one rock, that whole business. And in that, my mother represented and still represents a counter movement within human history that I think we best think of as an aspiration or as a possibility in human affairs, rather than thinking of it as a mission accomplished or something that we have over other people. It's, and I myself, and we can talk about this, I'm such a this would be part of the upbringing for sure. I so quibble over words that if I had said by way of introduction, hey, I was a little bit late because I was having coffee with Kanye or Bono or something like that, and you all laugh and you know that I'm not serious, I would nevertheless under my breath have to say, just kidding, because I don't feel comfortable with words not being true. And there's probably a little bit of that hell fear going on there. So, but in view of that, when asked if I'm a Christian, I am more comfortable saying I'm an aspiring Christian or I'm having a go at it. Doesn't mean that I don't believe that I'm saved or loved of God, but I think if we're going to handle the word conservatively, interestingly, if we're going to be conservative about it, we're going to have to hold up room for the possibility of Christianity happening as opposed to it being something that we think we're doing or we presume that we're doing just because we feel really intensely about things. In view of that, and many of these remarks I shared with almost none of you, but on your campus on Martin Luther King Day, it occurred to me conservatively, don't feel like you have to go up or down on what I'm about to propose right now. Maybe just think about it for later. But it occurred to me, because I was speaking on Martin Luther King Day, given that Christianity is a behavior, that love is a verb, that Christianity is an insistence upon enemy love as opposed to retaliation, revenge, spirals, escalating resentment. Given what Christianity in practice is, it seemed appropriate to me to say that Martin Luther King Day is the most specifically Christian holiday within American culture, maybe the given what's become of those other holidays, maybe the last one in some sense. And for that, I'm going to ask for, if you at least think that's a helpfully provocative word, I'd like for you to maybe nod or raise a single finger or something so I can know that someone somewhere is with me. Okay, thank you. I apologize for being frail in that way, but in order to just keep on going, I needed something a little bit like that. Okay. So my mother and my church, and this happened too. This is maybe appropriate for because we have St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. I myself, though growing up in Nashville, and though having relatives from this area, didn't really know about Martin Luther King until Martin Luther King made it to me, and by way of Martin King, that movement, for which he is certainly the brand image, but I think it's appropriate to say that the movement made the man rather than the man made the movement, because we know that King himself was something of a slow convert to creative nonviolence and nonviolent resistance. Even owned a gun for a long time, but it was eventually drawn into this other way of saying, okay, I'm going on a tangent, I'm sorry. Yes, I became aware of Martin Luther King, embarrassingly to myself, via the music of a struggling Irish folk band that we know of as U2. Perhaps you've heard of them. That's how they made it to me. You know, Rolling Stone, Bono mentions Flannery O'Connor, Pride in the Name of Love. That's how I got into it. Okay, so I'm attempting a continuum. My mother, the Rocks, Martin Luther King, creative nonviolence, and a sense within my upbringing that there's a discernible continuum that we could call a God's mercy movement. And the challenge that I began to feel as I started reading up on King, listening to you two, not easily separated, and collecting all manner of that kind of thing, I came to the place that I wanted to challenge myself, not just to be a recipient of God's mercy and love, but a practitioner. And I think that tension there, recipient, practitioner, we even have these parables that suggest that if you aren't a practitioner, we might do well to ask if we are very deeply converted to this movement, Jesus' kingdom movement that we call Christianity. Okay, I'm going to attempt a bit of a transition here. Is everybody with me still? Can you nod? And okay, thank you so much. Thank you. And feel free to do this at some point if you need to. There are people from time to time who try to live from time to time as if what Jesus taught is correct. That if what Jesus proposed about life, reality, human history is true. There's another tension that I want to address where we treat Jesus as a kind of get-out-of-hell-free card, or Jesus as a kind of barcode whereby we're going to enter into that more pleasant afterlife existence. I want to challenge us today as we rehearse some of the events of the civil rights movement, which I like to think of as ongoing, place it along the trajectory of Christianity. I want to challenge us to think of Jesus as more and ask ourselves the questions, if we actually believe that Jesus is Lord, if we actually believe that Jesus is God, if we're not taking Jesus's ethics seriously. There's a T-shirt. I apologize if anyone has ever worn one, but you know, you have the Got Milk ad campaign where you have celebrities with a little bit of white there. Okay, there are T-shirts that say Got God ? Or Got Jesus ? And I don't think it's appropriate or reverent, we might even want to say that it's blasphemous, to think of God and Jesus, in whom the deity fully dwells, as something that we could have over others, or as a kind of bragging right or boasting right over people who don't believe the right things. And again, in this sense, there was a presidential campaign commercial in which somebody going for the gold said, "I'm not ashamed to call myself a Christian." To which I get that, but I tended to think, you know, given what I've said before, that maybe we should be slower to do that. Okay, so people from time to time who live as if what Jesus taught was correct. There is a love-informed consciousness at work in the world, and it infects the way people treat each other, the way we talk about, you know, just to throw some slurs out there, rednecks, racists, terrorists, primitives, liberals, conservatives. This and again, whenever I think of these words that we use to avoid dealing with the complexity of each other. In our world or further out, I think of Jesus' word on not calling anyone a fool or an idiot. Raka, I think it's in there, but it's usually translated fool. Does the NIV say fool? Do we know what Eugene Peterson does with that word by any chance? Okay, fool, we do idiot an awful lot. That when we do that, we're speaking perversely of someone who is infinitely valuable, an infinitely valuable bearer of God's image. And one thing that King challenges us with is the notion that the image of God is never totally gone in a person. Whatever we make of a person, in terms of viewing them as radically evil or beyond the pale or a waste of skin, King challenges us, and I believe the biblical witness challenges us, to not pull that, to always insist upon seeing the image of God, even in people who are hateful toward us. This consciousness is simultaneously, gospel consciousness, I want to say, is simultaneously no respecter of persons and perhaps the only real respecter of persons. As a practice, it's never at our command, under our copyright, or effectively contained within an ism, an ideology, or any well-intentioned human construction. And again, think of the Got God t-shirt. Or to put it another way, no one has successfully gotten this Jesus. The question is always, and a question I want us to think through today, whether or not Jesus' rare ethic of being good to people has gotten hold of us in any meaningful way. I would like to bring in King's words on creative and constructive maladjustment. Being maladjusted to status quo, contempt, perversity, general disregard for the health of other people. King says, I never intend to adjust myself to the tragic effects of the methods of physical violence and to tragic militarism. I call upon you to be maladjusted in these ways. And he calls us to a kind of creative extremism. And he's going to give us some words here. I wanted to read some of his words. And again, on this business of direct action, the sit-ins, I'm going to mostly be talking about the sit-ins that have the lunch counter sit-ins that happened in Nashville within yards of the church that I go to, actually, in which students from TSU, from Fisk, from American Baptist, James Lawson, who I'd like to talk about, was a Vanderbilt Divinity student who got kicked out of Vanderbilt for being involved in these things. The deal, the scenario, the action, the protest went like this. Lunch counters, lunches, restaurants in downtown Nashville, all segregated. These students get together and decide to, African-American students, and decide to go into the restaurants of downtown Nashville and sit in the areas that are barred to them and wait for the police to come. As they're waiting, they are going to be, they might be struck, were often struck, they were threatened, they were, all kinds of words of contempt were hurled their way. But in order to do this, and this is something that Lawson had learned from Gandhi, and Gandhi had learned from Tolstoy, and Tolstoy had learned from Jesus of Nazareth, who we mean to celebrate and worship today. Lawson would train the students, and by doing these kind of dramas of acting it out, improv, in which students would play the role of Nashville citizenry who decide to behave violently toward these students who've decided to sit in a restricted area. And you would sign a kind of commitment card to not even respond, especially not respond. Say if you're sitting there quietly and you have a girl, you're a guy, you have a girl next to you, the guys are going to be very tempted, especially when men are calling women all kinds of things. And for instance, because this happened, threatening to pour battery acid down the necks of the students. You were trained to not respond. And if you knew that on that day, you were trained to not respond violently, and if you knew on that day that you weren't going to be able to hold it together, you were invited to wait till next week when they do it again. Lawson had to be very specific in this, and it worked. I mean, you can Google it, you can check it out, go for James Lawson, go for Nashville sit-ins. Eventually, the laws changed, and this was one instance. It happened all over the South of the beginning of a tide. Okay, so the situation, when I describe the Nashville sit-ins, lunch counter sit-ins, everybody knows or is beginning to know what I'm referring to. Can I have a nod? Possibly, okay, the finger. Thank you so much. Okay, so here's what King says about nonviolent direct action. This is the extremist. This is from the letter from Birmingham Jail. He says that he's disappointed at being categorized as an extremist. As I continue to think, this is King talking, about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute. Was not the prophet Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. Will we be extremists? Okay, so the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime, the crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. Okay, and if I can move a little over to a specific tale of James Lawson, who I took a course in nonviolent history with James Lawson. He would be a little over 80 at this point, but he and King worked together throughout the South. And one story that shows up in David Halberstam's The Children is as they were standing there on a Nashville street corner, being yelled at. Oh, and I forgot to mention this. As the police would arrive and take the students, put them in a van to put them in jail, students a block or two away were waiting to go into the same restaurant and sit down and do the same thing. So very, very tactical, very thought through. They filled up the jails, the prisons, for local crimes. The prisons of Nashville made it on the news, created a kind of crisis that King was purposefully trying to create in the minds of the public, the conscience of Nashville. Anyway, Lawson, who had trained, who had spent some time in jail for his nonviolent resistance, there was one instance in which he was standing on the sidewalk and a man, needless to say, a white man, called him a racial slur and spat in his face. As he looked at the man who had just spat in his face, and he said, "Sir, could I have a handkerchief?" And the guy, before he knew what he was doing, had reached in his pocket and handed him a handkerchief. And as Lawson is looking at him, wiping his eye, he says, "Is that your motorcycle over there?" And the guy says, "Yes." And he says, "What kind is it?" And before you know it, they're discussing horsepower. There's this move, a kind of a jiu-jitsu move, if you like. But again, these are the tactics that Jesus gives us, because turning the other cheek, walking the extra mile, handing over your tunic as well as your robe when someone demands it of you, these are all methods for responding to aggressors. And Lawson viewed, especially via the work of Howard Thurman, who gives us Jesus and the Disinherited, viewed this as a kind of survival manual. Not a survival manual in the sense that you definitely won't get killed or hurt, but you're insisting on responding redemptively to the hateful person, creatively to them, insisting upon looking at them as someone who, again, is infinitely valuable, infinitely interesting. It amazes me that Lawson was capable of that. And I asked him, you know, how do you do this sort of thing? And he said, and I wrote it down, and if you Google it, you will only find it on Google. But I put it in a book, but I was so pleased that I wrote it down when he said it, because otherwise it wouldn't be anywhere. He said, here's what you have to do. You have to collect in your life the imagery of infinite possibility. Okay, that would be worth writing down or tweeting or something. Collect, and it's not, and it has everything to do with prayer, with reading well, with collecting well. So I'm going to say it again. Collect in your life the imagery of infinite possibility. That can mean studying your Bible more. It can mean praying more. But for me, it means being alive to, being attentive to every instance of the truthful, the poetic, the apocalyptic, I would say, because I view the apocalyptic not as the Left Behind series, but apocalyptic as that, the book of Revelation, for instance, the apocalypse, John's apocalypse. I view the apocalyptic and the poetic as that which creatively disrupts the status quo, or that which cracks the pavement of the status quo. And for me, this business of collecting in your life an imagery of infinite possibility isn't all that different from making a mix CD of Radiohead songs for a friend who doesn't know Radiohead yet. Because to my mind, Radiohead, and I could stand up here and list off all kinds of folks, filmmakers, cartoonists, comic book writers, novelists, singers, who I think are involved in this work, that's part of collecting what I like to call cosmic plain speak. That which puts things differently, better, more redemptively. I would have a whole talk on that I'm not going to have time for. But are you at least feeling it or thinking, yeah, I'm going to try and, well, I'm not going to ask you to do this, but this collect in your own life an imagery of infinite possibility. Another way of putting it, and I'm going to have to draw from King here again on this one. Sorry for jumping back and forth like this. He talks about dramatizing the tensions that already exist in the way people relate to one another, and turning it up in a way that will expose injustice, make us think. Yeah, and I even want to, I mean, The Simpsons definitely does this. I even want to say that South Park does it from time to time, where it draws attention to contradictions within our world, unjust contradictions, that kind of thing. A guy named Fred Friendly, who was played by George Clooney in Good Night and Good Luck, said that the job of a news person, and I think this goes with storytelling, I think this goes with good preaching, good biblical exegesis, good singing, all of it. The job of a news person, the news bringer, the storyteller, is to create a pain in the viewer's mind that can only be relieved by thinking. Create a pain in the viewer's mind that can only be relieved by imagining a different world. N.T. Wright says something similar about Jesus' parables, that they don't just tell about a different world, a different order. They kind of make manifest that world in the telling. This breaking through. I know that I'm beginning to run out of time, so let me move on over here to, well, let's look at 2 Corinthians 5 real quick, because I think King's work, this posture that we're called to, this posture toward the world, this posture toward the artifacts of the world, and I'm thinking you know, Simpsons, Shakespeare, Bob Dylan, Radiohead albums, where we're not thinking, we're asking of our media, the media that we consume, is it truthful? And if it's truthful, it's good. Similarly, Madeline Lingle said, somebody asked Madeline Lingle, how do you know if a painting is Christian or a book is Christian? And she said, that's easy. If it's good, it's Christian. Which is a bit of a provocative word, but it's actually a more conservatively Christian word on art than we perhaps expect, because she believes that any truth, any goodness, any beauty, we have God to thank for. That it is so rare that we do well to celebrate it wherever it comes from. One way of thinking about this, a kind of goodness, truth, beauty, copyright, God. Yeah, okay, I'm so out of time, so I'm going to have to skip to this, and I'm not going to read this scripture from 2 Corinthians 5, I'm sorry. But it's at the end of chapter 5, and we're urged to be ambassadors of reconciliation, reconciling God rather than a condemning God or a God who hates all of the people that we hate. Okay, so I'm going to read a passage. I'm going to invite the band to come back up for another song. As you're coming up, I'm going to read these words to you, and then I'm going to tell you who said them, and then I'm going to say a little prayer. Okay, here we go. Oh, my goodness. Wait a second. 9. The response of the righteous to the suffering that the world inflicts on them is to bless. That was God's response to the world that nailed Jesus to the cross. Blessing. God does not repay evil for evil. And thus the righteous should not do so either. No judgment, no abuse, but blessing. The world would have no hope if this were not the case. The world lives by the blessing of God and of the righteous, and thus has a future. Blessing means laying one's hand on something and saying, despite everything, you belong to God. Okay, I'm going to ask you to stand up at this point. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you that this is Dietrich Bonhoeffer talking. Okay. Despite everything, you belong to God. This is what we do with the world that inflicts suffering upon us. We do not abandon it. We do not repudiate, despise, or condemn it. Instead, we call it back to God. We give it hope. We lay our hand on it and say, may God's blessing come upon you. Those who have been blessed can do nothing but pass on this blessing. Indeed, they must be a blessing wherever they are. I ask God now to energize us, invigorate us, renew our transformations in the direction of being a blessing to one another, and especially responding creatively, lovingly, and imaginatively toward those folks we like the least, whether on our tiny little screens or in person. Thank you for listening, and God be with you.